White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
This is your substitute host, Hadding Scott, trying to function in spite of bizarre technical difficulties, bizarre and disorienting technical difficulties. Didn't hear the music, didn't hear the 60 seconds thing, had to reconnect a couple of times, but I'm supposedly on now. Yes, this is certainly going as planned, yeah. All right. Hello, heretics. I'm here to talk to you about heretical things, particularly things relating to National Socialism, history that the establishment doesn't like, and also racial truth. I am going to start here with an essay, which is actually a speech. What is she telling me here? You're on. Okay, yes, I thought I was on. She's telling me I'm on. I'm going to start off with a couple of sections from a speech by Joseph Goebbels that I translated and put on my blog a while back. This is from about 1935. He talks about, it's called The Essence and Form of National Socialism. So this is Goebbels. The first day of August 1914 is historically regarded the crossroads, and already back then it must have dawned every historically thinking man, where we leave off today, we cannot go back after the Great War. 9 million German men went through the most frightening physical and spiritual pain. They went through every hell and purgatory of suffering, of human pain and human renunciation and depression. For them, it was impossible to resume where they had left off 4 years earlier. No, these men brought back from the trenches a new way of thinking. They had experienced in the terrible needs and dangers a new kind of community that never could have been granted to them in happiness. They had learned and experienced the sovereign equalization of death, so that finally only the values of character still existed. At the front, property, education, or a noble name no longer mattered. No distinction altered the course of bullets that cut down the exalted and the humble, the poor and the rich. The big and the small, for eternal equalization. Among men, only one single distinction continued to exist, personal merit. Never could the uniform make them equal if one was brave and another cowardly, if one conducted himself as a man and threw his life into the breastworks while the other tried to shirk. It was self-evident that this evaluation would carry across from the trenches into the homeland, and that the old statesmen who had remained at home and had no inkling of this new attitude would reject it. But it was only a question of time until, according to the law of force, the younger, harder, more courageous men must vanquish the older and more deficient in courage. The 9 million German front soldiers knew about the fragility of the regime that they were defending with their lives for the sake of the nation, about the fragility of it. They had experienced together how the entire world rose against Germany and had recognized that only with the application of all their forces, all their energies, could this threat be turned away. It became obvious that even the poorest folk comrade was devoted to his nation, even though he had never been conscious of it as his possession. He knew nothing about the cultural merits of his country. He knew the names Wagner, Beethoven, Mozart, Goethe, Kant, and Schopenhauer from hearsay at best. He would have been right to say, "The mines and quarries that we want to conquer mean nothing at all to me, since presumably it will be completely irrelevant to me whether I work for a German or a French owner." Nevertheless, one experienced that these men committed themselves to an ideal that, in its broad outlines, they didn't even know, which was the ideal of nationalism. Then later, as the severest stress test came, millions fell away again from this ideal out of ignorance or weakness. In other words, they betrayed their nation. But we were no folkish state, for such a state grows from being endangered. A folk, which I should tell you, a folk is a word in German that it connotes both people and nation. So a folk will never abandon its own state. The National Socialist movement has completed the opposite evolution. In crises, never did party comrades fall away from the movement, but always only supporters and voters. Party comrades responded by becoming more ruthless and active to fill the void, to take up the slack. Thus would it be also with a folk that remains clearly conscious of the value of its own folkish state. If the men who had risked their lives on the front had possessed a concept of the greatness, the value, and the achievement of a country that they defended, they would never have permitted that in the hour of decision this country would fall into the hands of political con men and profiteers. They would have fought back and would never have permitted the terrible sacrifices that had been made on the front to be bargained away and wasted. We Germans were never an imperial people and therefore also conducted no global politics. At the outbreak of the war, the nation was led by a man who was just as bad a philosopher as a statesman. After that, we did not learn at all from the failure of this man. Instead, the German statesmen became not younger but older, while on the enemy side the opposite occurred. He's referring to the Social Democrats that ruled in Germany after the First World War. On the opposite side, there real men stood at the helm, brutal power seekers, totally unencumbered with sentimentality, and remorseless in the use of armed forces. They did not let their parliaments spend weeks debating whether a mutinous sailor should be shot. Rather, they had the nerve to shoot the culprit. He's talking about the Allies in the First World War. They were very brutal, he says. We Germans won the war from a military perspective, but we lost all along the line politically. We had no war aim and conducted no global politics. For a muddled confusion of vague war aims, the proletarian was expected to risk his life. And so it happened that our front melted, our folk fragmented, and the concept of the folkish state had no permanence before the hardness of historic unfolding or evolution. After an heroically and courageously conducted war, the frightful catastrophe necessarily burst upon us. The upright, the best, the German patriots of the deed doubted the future of their people in those gray November weeks, and many of them perished. Today, we see things differently. We recognize the organic necessity and the usefulness of this development. And we understand the prophetic words of Müller Vandenbroek. He said, "We had to lose the war to win the revolution." If we proceed from the assumption that the war represented already a part of the revolution, which happened not in relationships, But in men, we come to the conclusion we had to lose the first part of the revolution in order to come to reflect openly and privately in the second, third, and fourth acts, and finally to win, after all. After the conclusion of the war, the enemy invented a peace treaty for Germany that, with elaborate cleverness amounted to destroying the nation of the Germans and finally striking it from the list of world powers. Yeah, they were trying to destroy Germany. Hitler talks about this in his second book. He says that the foreign policy aim of France had been consistently to break up Germany into little pieces and also to occupy the Rhine on both banks, continuing with Goebbels. That the parties of the Weimar system never recognized. A few years ago, even the bourgeois press in Germany still recoiled before the word tribute, and it was contended that the mere mention of the disgraceful Treaty of Versailles was able to poison relations in friendship among allied nations. We National Socialists have labored for years, making clear to our folk the complicated facts of the enemy's methods of enslavement. Today in Germany, every child in school knows the frightening effects of Versailles, and there is no longer any German who is not in the clear about the impact of the Tribute Treaty. But 15 years ago, the mutinous German chancellor could step before the nation and, regarding this disgraceful treaty, memorialize the utterance, "The German folk has been victorious all along the line." So he's saying, this social democrat was saying that the downfall of Imperial Germany was a victory for the German folk. That's why the National Socialists considered them traitors. What a change has been accomplished in these last 15 years of struggle. One can in fact say peoples are not always the same. All propensities for good or evil lie in them, and it depends always on their leaderships whether nations resolve for good or evil. The German people of today must not be compared with that of 1918, just as little as the masses of 1918 can be set in comparison with the nation of 1914. Here we are dealing with a fundamentally different mentality, with a different mode of thinking, a new sense of community, and a closer cohesion. So what it means is that through the bad experience of the war, German people became unified. Okay, this is another section from the same speech. Often the private request is made to us National Socialists to modify this or that terminology and to modify our party platform. They say, "Why do you people call yourselves socialists? Social is enough. Ultimately, we're all social anyway, but take away that awful word, and we would all be in the fullest agreement." No, we National Socialists cannot do that, for it is something fundamentally different if I'm presented as social or socialist. Likewise, if we are presented as national or nationalist, next to the concept national usually stands the little word also. And that is what matters. Here is the dividing line between two worlds. The National Socialist has dedicated himself to his people with flesh and blood, with body and soul. Never will the true nationalist pronounce the empty phrase, "It is sweet and honorable to die for the fatherland." That's a quote from a Roman poet. What's his name? Can't think of his name right now. But there's a Roman poet from the Augustan age. He was a Stoic, and he wrote some poem that translates, with the line, it translates, "It is sweet and honorable to die for the fatherland." And apparently this was a popular thing to say during the First World War. The National Socialist is too honest for that, and he loathes to degrade his eternal vigilance with drivel in the marketplace of the bourgeois public. The same applies to the concept of socialism. All right, let me just skip some of this stuff here. Ugh. Yeah. I wanted to give you some information about National Socialism here, because I get people asking me to talk about National Socialism because they don't really know what it is. They know that they've been lied to. But what I wanted to convey with this stuff from Goebbels was that National Socialism was born in the First World War from the experience of the soldiers. They developed camaraderie as Germans, as members of the same people. As Goebbels mentioned there, class barriers were broken down. It didn't matter if you were rich or poor, or if you were a Junker or a peasant. It all depended on your performance. And this is something that National Socialism wanted to establish, is a meritocracy without regard for class. That was a new thing that Hitler established, which survived him. Another way in which National Socialism probably was born during the First World War is through the fact that an army is inherently a socialist enterprise. This is something that Gustave Le Bon mentions. Gustave Le Bon, he wrote The Crowd, and he also wrote a book called The Psychology of Socialism. He says that every army is a socialist enterprise. Think about how an army functions. It's a government entity. It makes sure that everybody has enough of whatever supplies they need. But it also requires performance. There's an obligation down as well as back up. Obligation to the individual as well as loyalty required. Now, contrast that to the society in which we live here. Ordinary people are expected to obey the law, but what does the government do for ordinary people here? For the most part, you're on your own. You're not guaranteed very much. You're lucky if they even enforce the law, actually. Okay, this is a thing called Marxism or nationalism. Do I want to read this? Might as well. Marxism stands for democracy, the international pacifism, and the class struggle with the goal of the... Oh, let's skip that. Skip that. Yeah. Some guy was asking me to explain National Socialism a couple of days ago. And I explained it in social and economic terms. And some other guy that was listening said, "That's the worst explanation of National Socialism that I ever heard. National Socialism is about a dictator telling everybody what to do." That's what people think if they learn about it from Hollywood and from TV. Let's see here. What have I got? Okay. The essence of Marxism is the class struggle leading to the leveling of society. National Socialism is about class reconciliation. National Socialism pulls the rug out from under Marxism. National Socialism replaces cutthroat capitalism with an economic order that is tolerable and viable without leveling society. I won't say that there's no competition under National Socialism, since all are not made equal. There is higher and lower status, and people will compete for that. But getting the most money is no longer the meaning of life in such a system. Why should economic competition be the meaning of life and the criterion by which every man is judged? A relatively non-competitive society in which people are valued for who they are is actually not so unusual. I think that's a pretty good description of medieval Europe, where everybody was expected to do his job, of course, but not strive to change his status within society. A reduction of economic competition is appropriate under the global conditions that have prevailed for the past century. Unrestrained economic competition leads to massive unemployment, such as we are now experiencing, and which would be much worse if the country were not currently involved in several wars, which act as a government jobs program. Yeah, basically the unemployment really encourages people to sign up for the military. Ultimately, the USA will have to move to some kind of more regulated economy, at least as much as it had from Franklin Roosevelt until Ronald Reagan, before all that deregulation. That will be an economy in which competition is muted. The only question after that is whether that change will be accompanied by national socialistic measures to maintain discipline and prevent the biological decay of the population. Most likely the USA will not do that, but other countries will. Whether we like it or not, Germany, I think, for example, and probably some East Asian countries. I read a couple of years ago that Thailand was taking measures to increase their average IQ. And they're doing something like that in China also. Whether we like it or not, social order in some form is on its way back. And the war of all against all is on its way out. Continuing on the present course would produce a kind of Mad Max world, that is, this kind of unregulated capitalism. Those Mad Max movies are really kind of a caricature of a capitalist society where they were all competing for petroleum. Since very few people will want that, I don't believe it's going to happen. Adjustments and accommodations will be made. Well, Jews, what about the Jews? The Jews are in the way of making these adjustments and accommodations and having a harmonious society. You cannot have a cohesive and harmonious society where Jews have any significant power, because the Jews are all about maintaining their collective distinctness without having to risk being either subsumed or expelled from the society. The Jew depends on social conflict. He has to keep a society disunited and weak for his parasitism to continue. That's why the class struggle and racial strife and large-scale non-white immigration are all pushed by the Jews. All right, this is an article. Actually, it's a series of three sections from a book called Freispruch für Deutschland, Acquittal for Germany. It's by Heinrich Hertler. Heinrich Hertler was a German philosopher or scholar of philosophy. And he's most known for a book about Nietzsche that he wrote during the National Socialist period. And the reason why people have heard of this is that Walter Kaufmann, who is this Jew that did several translations of Nietzsche, he did a bunch of Nietzsche translations, and he teaches at some university in Israel. He mentions Hertler's book about Nietzsche and tries to portray National Socialists as distorting Nietzsche and using Nietzsche falsely to prop up National Socialism. In other words, this Jew, Walter Kaufmann, accuses the National Socialists of misrepresenting Nietzsche as being one of them. This is simply false. It's false. There is some influence of Nietzsche in National Socialism. For example, the psychologists who wrote during the National Socialist period often refer to Nietzsche, because Nietzsche was the one that started the, well, how can I say this? In philosophy, anyway, he's the one that sort of started the non-metaphysical view of man. In other words, man as a biological entity, which is really the way psychology looks at man for the most part today. And that's the way the psychologists during the Third Reich looked at man's psychology. And when you look at man as a biological entity, also race figures into it, because when you have a different physical type, you're also going to have a different mental type. Well, anyway, in his book about Nietzsche, Hertle had some quotes from Nietzsche, and one of them was a quote that said, perhaps the stock market Jew is the most repulsive creature, something like that. And there were some parenthetical words there that Hertle left out, and Kaufmann makes a big deal about this. The parenthetical words don't really change the meaning, but, you know, Kaufmann is really grasping at straws to try to claim that Nietzsche was, if possible, the very antithesis of a National Socialist. This is what you get. Actually, I have a speech. I have a copy of a speech that Alfred Rosenberg gave in 1944 on the 100th anniversary of Nietzsche's birth. And Rosenberg flat out says that Nietzsche was not a National Socialist, that he was a kind of a fragmented thinker and didn't really have a systematic social doctrine, you know. So National Socialism, even according to the National Socialists, Nietzsche was not a National Socialist. And there are a few points of resonance between, just a few, between Nietzsche and National Socialism. But you can also explain those by the fact that the ideas that Nietzsche expressed were ideas that were sort of in the air at the time. He represented a tendency. And another person that represented similar ideas was Julius Langbein. Julius Langbein wrote a book called Rembrandt als Erzieher, Rembrandt as an Educator. And this was a very influential book. I haven't read, but from what I've read about it, it conveys some ideas that are very similar to Nietzsche's. And this was extremely popular, Rembrandt als Erzieher. It was a very popular book with the Van der Vogel, who were like hippies in the beginning of the 20th century. They were like hippies, except that they were nationalists. And they were sort of Nietzschean. One of them, who later was a National Socialist, one of these Van der Vogel, was Adolf Eichmann. He had been a Van der Vogel. And a lot of them also joined, these Van der Vogel also joined the Freikorps and helped to put down the communist insurrections after the First World War. All right, so this is Heinrich Hertle. And he's writing about whether Hitler was responsible for the war between Germany and the Soviet Union. In other words, why did Hitler attack the Soviet Union in 1941, in June 1941? Hitler or Stalin? When the mea culpists of the post-war Federal Republic of Germany, by the way, this is written in 1965. When the mea culpists of the post-war Federal Republic of Germany wished to prove the sole guilt of Germany for the war with Russia, they begin, like the Nuremberg prosecutors, with Mein Kampf. There it can be read in black and white that this Hitler, already in 1924 and 25, had decided to solve the German need for space, the mismatch of greater population and smaller territory, and that he would conquer the sparsely settled Russian territories with sword and plow in an eastern campaign of the Germane. It might, however, be a monstrous overestimate of the genius of this man, Hitler, if one construes a direct causal relationship between the theories in 1924 of the youthful leader of a wrecked fringe party and the foreign policy situation of 1941. Later, Hitler explained, quote, "If I had suspected in 1924 that I would become Chancellor of Germany, I never would have written the book," close quote. So in other words, the people that are accusing Hitler give him too much credit for prescience, is what Hertel is saying. Just the difference between the Russia of Lenin on the brink of chaos and crippled with famines and the megalithic Stalinist empire of 1941 shows the absurdity of this interpretation. The Eastern settlement theories in Mein Kampf presuppose a Russia collapsing from its own weakness. Of course, Hitler as chancellor assumed that a clash between National Socialist Germany and world revolutionary Soviet imperialism would be inevitable, and that he must do everything to prepare for this danger. The gathering of all Germans into a Great Germany, Großdeutschland, and Hitler's policy of reconciliation with the West, especially his offers of friendship to England, served this purpose. Großdeutschland means Germany and Austria combined. Great Germany in English. When, however, England and France had demonstrated through their guarantee to Poland that they were unwilling to tolerate a Germany that would have been strong enough to stand up to the growing Soviet colossus, Hitler began to reorient his foreign policy tactics from west to east. He stopped trying to make an alliance with Britain, in other words, because he couldn't get it. In mid-1939, when England and France were trying to complete their encirclement policy by enlisting even the Soviet Union in a military and war alliance against the Reich, Hitler saw only one remaining escape route from the looming political and military trap: flight forward, a breakout to the east through reconciliation with Russia. Through that alone, he believed, at least in the beginning when Germany was wedged between France, England, and America on one side and Poland and Russia on the other, through that alone he believed that he would be able to avert a two-front war. Russia's friendship had to, that's in quotes there, Russia's friendship had to be reckoned as costly because of concessions not only in Poland, but also in the Baltic and the Balkans. See, the agreement was that they would partition Poland on the Oder-Neisse line, Oder and Neisse rivers, but the Soviet Union would also occupy the Baltic states, which produced a lot of German refugees. They went back to Germany. I may be getting something wrong there, actually. But also part of Romania was occupied by the Soviet Union. England and France had already offered this price in their negotiations. Germany could only purchase the accord with Russia by outbidding the pre-existing Western offer. Meanwhile, Stalin was counting on the certainty of a war waged by England and France against Germany, wherein he could at first remain uninvolved so as to prepare his military might and at the favorable moment enter the war and win, either with the Reich against the capitalist West or, even better, with the capitalist West against National Socialist Germany. This calculation turned out to be erroneous insofar as Germany conquered Poland and France in such an astonishingly short time that Stalin could not have expected it. And I have commented on occasion that when France fell to Germany in only a matter of a few weeks, there probably was an audible expletive uttered in the Kremlin. Oh, crap! You could just imagine that. And Stalin must have been panicked in the late summer of 1940. Since Stalin in 1939 and 1940 had based his calculation on the hostility between Germany and France and England, he saw in the German peace offers to France and England in the fall of 1939, after the invasion of Poland, and to England in 1940, thus precisely in the German desire for peace, the defining reason for his change of position against the Reich and for its Western enemies. In other words, Stalin saw the fact that Hitler wanted to make peace with England and France as a sign of weakness. So he was going to side with them. Now the Bolshevik dictator began to ally himself with England and America against the ever stronger Germany, so as to expand the Soviet dictatorship into Europe and Asia with the help of democracy and capitalism. Stalin's calculation, however, was thwarted in the beginning. Hitler decided, as soon as he had recognized this danger, on an active defense against the East by means of a sudden preemptive war, so as to avoid the looming two-front war with England and America on one side and the Soviet bloc on the other. Whoever waxes indignant over the undertaking of a preemptive war, let him recall how Lenin thought about this. Lenin said, if in the face, should I do an accent here? If in the face of a hostile behaving troops, we gave assurance that we should never resort to certain actions which could be called offensive from the military strategical point of view, then we would be not only fools, but criminals as well. But whoever would like to search after the historical roots of this decision must not begin in 1924 with Hitler, the leader of an, at that time, wrecked party, but with the Soviet dictator Lenin, who announced, "No power in the world can stop the course of the communist world revolution to the Soviet world republic." All right. The second war guilt lie. We wish never to blame our enemies in order to exonerate Hitler. What he's saying is, we won't blame, he's saying as a German, he's saying he doesn't want to make excuses for Hitler beyond reason. We also wish, however, under no circumstances to blame Hitler merely to exonerate our enemies. Compared to this question of the nation's destiny, the assessment of Hitler and National Socialism is completely secondary. We shall deny no German guilt because it is Hitler's fault, but we shall also swear off no vindication of Germany merely because it could be interpreted as also favorable to Hitler. Bonn and Pankow, which are the seats of government for the two post-war German states, East and West Germany. Bonn and Pankow have always acted according to the opposite principle. Every incrimination of Germany must be accepted if only the Third Reich and its government together can thereby be branded. In other words, these were not nationalist governments. They were eager to blame their nations for any wrongdoing. Although I have a recent blog post that I put up based on a couple of paragraphs from an article in Der Spiegel. It turns out that the reason why Konrad Adenauer agreed to pay reparations, agreed that Germany, West Germany, would pay reparations to the state of Israel, was that the United States put pressure. There were going to be some kind of dire consequences for Germany if Adenauer didn't agree with that. And it wasn't stated in the article in Der Spiegel what kind of consequences, but something very bad. And interestingly enough, Adenauer also lied about it in his memoirs. But there were some official papers about the matter that were released recently that revealed this. And you can find that on my blog. It's http://national-socialist-worldview.blogspot.com. Okay, back to Hertle. The Soviet draft for our peace treaty of 1959 begins exactly like the Dictate of Versailles in 1919 with the war guilt lie. Here is the consequence, not only for Bonn and Pankow, but certainly for the German people, of the fact that some people accuse their nation of war crimes in order to excuse their own collaboration with the Allies. Here recurs the guilt accusation from Moscow that has burdened us since Nuremberg. Even more brutally than in paragraph 231 of the Versailles Dictate, that's what they call a It's what German nationalists call the Treaty of Versailles. They call it the Versailles Dictate. The Kremlin affirms in the preamble of its peace treaty the sole and collective guilt of Germany for the war, which had been caused by Hitler Germany, not only by Hitler, and for the, quote, aggression against the peoples of Europe, close quote, that were committed by German militarism, not only by the Nazis. The Soviet government still consistently demands in 1959 the contractual acknowledgement of the historical lies of 1946 Nuremberg. This new war guilt clause reads, Germany acknowledges the verdict of the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg and the verdicts of other courts in regard to crimes committed both inside and outside of Germany, which the statute of this tribunal provides. Paragraph 19. This was some treaty that the Soviet Union offered to Germany, because as far as I know, Germany never got a peace treaty with the Western Allies after World War II, and was never offered one. There was an armistice, but no peace treaty. This reference to the Shylock verdict at Nuremberg surely demonstrated to every German that the USSR needed this second war guilt lie as the basis for its robber's peace, not only to divert attention from its own war guilt, but also to acquire a signed authorization from Germany for future extortions. That's actually an important principle there. When you admit guilt, when you admit guilt once, they might come back for more. That's what happened in the case of the agreement that Adenauer made. They agreed to pay a certain amount of money over 15 years, I think it was, 14 or 15 years, and it's been a lot more than that since then. Already at Nuremberg, however, the following facts have spoken against the Bolshevik war guilt lie. Until today, there has been no punitive law in international justice that criminalizes war as a tool of policy. This is true for 1939 to 41, just as for the wars since 1945. In other words, waging war is not a crime under any law. Two, that the actions of 1941 were a preemptive strike in defense of Germany, permitted under international law, is most strongly proven by the strategic situation. It would have been political and military madness that contradicted all accomplishments of the German leadership up to that point if someone had given up the victory over England, certainly possible at that time. If we had given up the victory over England, certainly possible at that time, in order to attack Russia. If the German leadership had not been compelled first to fight off the threat in the East. And actually, the way that Germany could have beaten Britain in 1941, if they had not had to fight the Soviet Union, would have been by going through Spain and taking Gibraltar, and then pushing Britain to the Suez Canal and taking the Suez Canal, and basically turning the Mediterranean into an Axis lake. At that point, there was some document that's been released since the war. It was just came out a couple of years ago that said that if that had happened, the British would have sued for peace. So forcing Britain to make peace was possible in 1941 if Germany had not had to deal with the Soviet Union. The German preemptive decision was unfortunately also bound up with a complex underestimation of the Red Army. Stalin had succeeded so cleverly in disguising his real military strength that even the Western General Staff was deceived. Foster Dulles writes in 1944, "The defeat of Russia was a question of weeks. Three quarters of the American General Staff was convinced that Russia was as little able to resist as Poland, France, and the Balkans." So the American executive branch officials thought that Russia was going to fall the way Poland had fallen, Poland and France. Even Churchill believed that the Finnish War had put on display the incompetence of the Red Army and Air Force. That's what he said. It's not a very good Churchill, but oh well. Even Hitler had been deceived through the chief of his general staff. On the 3rd of July, 1941, Halder says, "It is thus probably not overstated if I assert that the campaign against Russia was won within 14 days. So General Halder thought the war against the Soviet Union had been won in the first 2 weeks of the campaign. On the 11th of August, 1941, he admits the miscalculation. "We calculated at the beginning of the war based on 200 enemy divisions. Now we count 360 enemy divisions." Because of this underestimate, it was believed possible to force a more rapid decision in the East than turned out to be the case. Three, Soviet Russia had already demonstrated its policy of aggression. Okay, the Polish War, the portion of the causes of war with Germany could be He mentions that, Soviet Union's policy of aggression, they took half of Poland in 1939. The Soviet Union itself supported what it now calls German war guilt. It says that Stalin officially congratulated Hitler in 1939 and 40 for his victories over Poland and France. So there you go. Stalin congratulates Hitler for his victories, and then they call it German war guilt. In the same fall of 1939, the Soviet Union attacked Little Finland and thereby threatened Germany in the northeast. In 1940, Stalin subjugated the Baltic states just as violently as a little earlier, Bessarabia and North Bukovina, which are parts of Romania. Four, precisely on account of the repeated German peace offers to France and England, Stalin feared the end of Europe's fratricidal war, and therefore directed his aggression since fall 1940 also against Germany in violation of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. The American Secretary of State Burns writes in his memoirs, "It is obvious that the Soviet government has concluded this pact with the clear intention of breaking it." So says Secretary of State Burns. Even Czechoslovakian President Edvard Beneš affirms in his memoirs that the Soviet Union concluded the non-aggression pact only to gain time, in other words, so as to enter the war later when the warring parties had been weakened. Five, Molotov's November 1940 extortion attempt in Berlin already practically signaled Stalin's determination for war. He was pressuring Germany, which was still at war with England, and already in a de facto war with the United States, to hand over to the Soviet Union the Balkans, the Baltic Sea, and above all, the war-deciding oil supply in Romania, thereby making it clear that he would stab Germany in the back at the first opportunity. You get that? In November 1940, the Soviet Union was trying to pressure Germany for territorial concessions, big territorial concessions. Six. Already in 1940, Stalin had begun negotiations in Moscow with the English representative, Sir Stafford Cripps, thus with the enemy of a still allied Germany. Well, they had a non-aggression pact. You can call it an alliance, I suppose. England on this occasion made offers anew to Stalin, which far exceeded the 1939 abandonment of the Balkans, the Baltic states, and Poland. Seven. Already in spring 1941, the anti-German putsch in Yugoslavia, which mortally threatened Germany's position in the Balkans and therewith its oil supply, had been instigated and supported by Moscow together with England. Yeah, a lot of people don't know this. This has fallen down the memory hole. But Yugoslavia was at one point allied with Germany in the Second World War. Not yet in the war, really, but there was an alliance which was canceled because the government of Yugoslavia was overthrown. Eight, the Red Army increased its divisions in Germany's rear from 65 divisions in September 1939 to 153 divisions and 36 motorized brigades in 1940-41. Nine, Germany's preemptive war forestalled a gigantic Soviet offensive. The Bolshevik danger was even greater than could be reported previously. One of Hitler's enemies, General Chief of Staff Halder, demonstrated that. He affirms that Hitler's conviction that Russia was preparing for an attack on Germany was correct and declares, "We know today from good sources that he was right about that." Yeah, General Halder is saying Hitler was right, the Red Army was going to attack. Already in Nuremberg, General Winter testified under oath, "We had at that time the subjective impression that we were striking into an offensive deployment in progress." Field Marshal von Rundstedt is also a witness to that, that they saw that the Red Army was deployed for attack. Number 10, the Jewish-British emigrant Alexander Wirth, who inwardly still stands on the Soviet side, in other words, he's still pro-Soviet, and was able to participate as a correspondent on the side of the enemy, proves after 20 years how justified the fears of the German leadership were. He reports about Stalin's speech of the 5th of May, 1941. "All my sources agree in fundamental features with the most important points of Stalin's speech, the conviction that the war almost unavoidably would be in 1942, wherein, if necessary, the Soviets must seize the initiative." So spoke Stalin in May 1941. All right, we'll be back.
Im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechen Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechen Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon Staat. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon Staat. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Schützen und haben allem entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Helden und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Okay, I guess we're back now. This is Hadding Scott sitting in for Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour. Hello, heretics. Our heretical discussion at this moment focuses on why Adolf Hitler launched Operation Barbarossa. And just before the break there, I read a quote from a British Jew, communist Jew, apparently, named Alexander Werth or Wert, who was pro-Soviet. And he wrote that Stalin was contemplating an attack in May of 1941. In May, 5th of May 1941, which is just a short time before Barbarossa was launched against the Soviet Union, because that was launched in June 1941. So Heinrich Hertle continues, after two decades, the testimony of General Jodl is thereby proven correct on all essential points from the Soviet side, from somebody on the Soviet side, which would be Alexander Wert. In his conversation with Hitler in fall 1940, when the possibility of a preemptive war against the Bolshevik threat first comes up, The problem of an expansion of living space, or Lebensraum, and farmland is never mentioned. You see, this is what they always like to say, is that the reason why Hitler launched Operation Barbarossa is that he wanted Lebensraum. And he did write about the need for Lebensraum, and in the so-called secret book, he even says that it should be at the expense of the Soviet Union. However, the circumstances under which Barbarossa was launched had nothing to do with that. It was launched out of necessity. Posthumously, the cause and effect, even in this question, are reversed. That's quite a sentence. The original goal of the Eastern campaign was not to secure the German food supply. The problem of living space could have been solved with or against Russia, and also with or against England and France, after eliminating Anglo-French supremacy in Africa. In 1941, the question was unresolved. So what he's saying is that there was more than one way for Germany to get her Lebensraum in early 1941. Going to war against the Soviet Union was not the only option for that problem. In the foreground stood the problem of an Anglo-American and Soviet-Russian encirclement through the Pravenira in the east. And I think what this means is that, well, I'm not sure what it means. Just continue. As the preemptive war by then had become inescapable, the enormous sacrifice of blood could not be made for nothing. Simultaneously with the expansion of the food supply in the East, the eastern borders of Europe should be secured for centuries. Meanwhile, next to the real plans, there were also fantastic plans drawn up about the new order of Eastern Europe. Likewise, after the beginning of the First World War, borders were sought in the West that would justify the commitment and guarantee the security of the Western border for generations. In both cases, these plans were not the original purpose of the war. In other words, the plans about settling German farmers in the Crimea were an afterthought. Since they were at war, they decided to establish a war aim that would make it all worthwhile. To a related question posed by Dr. Exner, who was Jodl's attorney, General Jodl testifies, quote, "The Führer has never named in my presence even just one hint of a reason other than the purely strategic." For months on end, Hitler continuously repeated to Jodl's face, "There is no doubt now that England puts her hopes in this last mainland proxy. Otherwise, she would have already called off the war after Dunkirk. Under the hand or under the cover, agreements have certainly already been made. The Russian deployment is unmistakable. One day, suddenly, we shall be either coldly blackmailed or attacked." Now, thus spoke Hitler. Jodl himself had placed great hopes in the famous negotiations with Molotov, for with a neutral Russia in the rear, which furthermore would help us, meaning Germany, with economic supplies, an invasion such as occurred in June 1944 would never have been possible. No statesman and no field marshal could sacrifice such a favorable situation without necessity. It is a fact that Hitler for months struggled inwardly in the most serious way with this decision, certainly influenced by the many opposing pictures that both the Reichsmarschall and the Supreme Commander of the Kriegsmarine, as well as the Foreign Minister, raised. That was in quotes there. Even in the Balkans, the hostile doings of the Soviet government in combination with England and Yugoslavia compelled the final decision. General Jodl testifies, This is at Nuremberg. Until then, the Führer still had doubts. On the 1st of April, and no sooner, on the 1st of April, his decision to conduct the attack stood firm. And on the 1st of April, he gave the order to expect it for approximately the 22nd of June. The attack order itself, thus the actual unleashing of the campaign, that was only ordered on the 17th of June, which is likewise documented. And that was Jodl. To his defense attorney's question whether late discoveries had proven the military necessity of this decision, Jodl testified, "It was without a doubt a purely preventive war. What we later established was in any case the certainty of an enormous Russian military preparation facing our borders. I want to forego details, but I can just say that we succeeded in achieving tactical surprise with the day and hour of attack, but not strategic surprise. Russia was fully prepared for war." And that was Jodl. Continuing, Senior General Jodl again named an essential reason for the aggressive defense. "We were never strong enough to be able to defend ourselves in the East. Events since the year 1942 have proven it. It may sound grotesque, but in order to cover this front of over 2,000 kilometers, we would have needed at least 300 divisions, and we never had that. If we had waited until we had been caught, perhaps in the pincers of a simultaneous Allied invasion and Russian attack, with certainty we would have been lost." The attorney, Dr. Exner, proved the justification of a preemptive war precisely in this case. Quote, "The true preemptive war is one of the essential means of self-preservation. It was also indisputably permitted according to the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Thus was the right of defense of all signatory states understood." Close quote. In a secret session of the House of Commons in 1940, Churchill rationalized his rejection of the German peace offer and his decision to broaden the war with the affirmation that he had at that time, because of the negotiations conducted by the ambassador Sir Stanford Cripps in Moscow, obtained the explicit pledge that the Soviet Union would enter the war on the English side. So already in 1940, Churchill was telling the House of Commons in a secret session, some members of the House of Commons maybe, that the Soviet Union was going to enter the war. In 1940, he knew this. Okay. That is the end of that. I have something else to read here. I hope that was okay. I'm not as happy with the material that I have presented this week as I was last week, but I hope at least you've got something out of it. It's good information, even if some of it is clumsily worded. All right, I have something else here. This is a book called The American Negro as a Dependent, Defective, and Delinquent by Charles H. McCord, 1914. And I've selected a section from it. "There were undeniably grave evils connected with and growing out of slavery. But it must be remembered that there are evils connected with all human institutions and every social order. If the Negro were to be civilized in America at all, slavery was the easiest and most humane method by which it could be accomplished. In his own land, he could neither evolve a progress of his own nor preserve a civilization thrust upon him. Much less could he have survived in competition with the white man in the white man's land. The aboriginal American, a much stronger character than the Negro, and on his own ground, utterly failed. Dr. J. Stanley Hall has shown us how sadly true it is that primitive races invariably perish in the presence of the white race, and that will finally be the Negro's fate as a race in America. The most striking thing, of course, is that nobody would talk this way today, right? The whole range of discourse has been shifted so that you just don't even think these thoughts. Continuing with McCord. A careful and unbiased comparison of the physical, mental, and moral characteristics of the native African with those of the American Negro of today will show that the lasting evils of slavery were mainly sins of omission rather than commission. The slaveholder might very well have given more time and attention to the intellectual and moral development of his slaves. Among the delinquencies of the Negro, which are so often charged to slavery as a cause, may be mentioned especially the following. 1. Theft. The explanation given is that the Negro labored to produce his master's goods, felt that he received nothing in return, but in equity was justly entitled to a division of the profits. He therefore took from his master and so formed the habit, his offspring absorbing, as it were, his moral attitude and practicing theft as a part of his social heredity. But Miss Kingsley says of the Lower Guinea natives, "Stealing is a beloved pastime, a kind of game in which you only lose if you are found out." So that's, they're doing it in Africa, too. In Africa, they steal all the time. Bozeman, writing of the Slave Coast natives, says, "The natives of the Gold Coast are thievish, but not to be compared with these." Pogg says, "He lies, steals, betrays wherever he can." Ratzel was a German geographer. Ratzel says, "Their sense of the distinction between meum and tuum is often highly undecided between mine and yours." Number 2, lying. Yeah, Negro vice number 2, lying. First one was thieving. The explanation is that slavery under the Negroes, that under slavery, the Negroes were defenseless and subject to abuses, and so in ignorance and self-defense, resorted to lying, formed the habit, and handed it down by social heredity. But Sir A.B. Ellis, discussing the West African, says, "Concealment of design is the first element of safety, and as this axiom has been consistently carried out for generations, the national character is strongly marked by duplicity." Duplicity means dishonesty. Duchalieu adds, "Lying is thought an enviable accomplishment among them, and a more thoroughgoing and unhesitating liar than one of these Negroes is not to be found anywhere." Ratzel speaks of the Africans' hereditary sin of lying. No, Negro vice number 3, improvidence, means not looking ahead. The explanation is that the Negro never had anything of his own to care for during slavery, and that in his helplessness had no means of resentment or of venting spite except by careless or willful destruction and wastefulness. But as a matter of fact, in his native land, he lived only in the present. In his native land, he lived only in the present. The very climate and uncertainties of life conduced to inactivity and impatience with what did not concern the moment. Every traveler in African lands remarks upon this trait of African character. It may be added that slaves were usually allowed patches, pigs, poultry, and sometimes a cow. In other words, they were allowed to have some things of their own. Well, that they could treat as if they were their own anyway. They could sell their products from these and apply the proceeds as they pleased. Oh, so they were allowed to own those things. A little patch of land, some animals. Many thrifty slaves thus bought their freedom. But granting the explanation, social heredity, handed down through so short a bondage, could not become so permanent as to appear so nearly universal in the present generation of Negroes. Negro vice number 4, lack of self-control. Well, that's a biggie right there. The explanation is that the Negro was not his own master, but was under submission to those who fought and willed for him. And thus he came out from the restraints of slavery, unpracticed in the art of self-control. Slavery certainly did not afford much opportunity for independent initiative, if the Negro ever had any. But it did teach him such habits of self-restraint as he possessed, for I have already shown under another heading how he was in his native state the puppet of his impulses and the victim of every passing suggestion. In other words, in Africa, they were impulsive. Negro vice number 5, loose and unstable family life. The explanation is that masters assigned husbands and wives to suit their own convenience and separated them at pleasure, and to accommodate the domestic slave trade or settle estates, whole or parts of families were disposed of just as livestock. But it must be remembered that marriage in the orthodox way was generally practiced, and separation was more often at the request of husband and wife than by will of the master, or the vicissitudes of the slave trade. And slaves of different masters were allowed to marry and rear families, the children being the property of their mother's master. Chosen wives or husbands were often bought for slaves. In other words, you had a black slave that had a hankering for a certain other slave. Very often, that other slave would get bought, and they would make the accommodation. That's what he's saying. This is 1914, not that long after slavery had ended. So, you know, there were people that still had living memory that could say it wasn't true if it wasn't true. Chosen wives or husbands were often bought for slaves, and masters generally refused to separate families till death or necessity compelled. But the more important fact is that the Negro never had a home or knew anything of the monogamic family and the proper rearing of children as a social institution within historic times. His African sex mores were as little understood in America as the American Orthodox method of mating was in Africa, and would not have been tolerated had they been known. But the tradition of the old sex mores and the temperament of the Negro made it next to impossible to force upon him a well-ordered family life. I would also remind you from last week, we were reading W.M. Beavis, the psychiatrist, and he mentions that the slave owners built special galleries in their churches for the black slaves to attend church services. So they were interested in the well-being of their slaves, apparently. At least many of them were. The rearing of offspring in Africa is very similar to the rearing of young by the higher forms of the lower animals. The mother cares for the child till it leaves the breast some 2 or 3 years, and then it is turned loose to work out its own destiny. Everyone who has observed Negroes closely knows how careless even the American Negro mother is of her children, and how much more shifty a little Negro is than a little white child. And this helps to explain the enormous mortality among Negro children. The African father begets the child, and if it is a female, gets the head money when she is married, whatever that means. He seems to assume no other responsibility. There is no family affection except between mother and son in the African family, so that we easily exaggerate the anguish and sorrows of separation during slavery. Yeah, they've got all these sad stories cooked up to make us feel bad for the poor black slaves, when they probably lived better than poor white people in many cases. Negro vice number 6, sexual immorality. The explanation given is, in the words of the Honorable Simeon E. Baldwin, writing upon the history of American morals, One class of our working women has in times past suffered greatly at the hands of American men. I refer to the slaves of the South. Their master's sons often used with them more than the license of the medieval landlord with his tenantry. It was part of a system which belonged to a past generation, but the laxity of morals which characterized it took hold upon its victims and has gone through them to infect the whole colored race of the southern states. Now, I have no disposition to apologize for any of the shameful prostitution of body or blood of which the southern slave master may have been guilty, but I may ask, are there no mulattoes bearing in their veins strains of Puritan blood as a relic of New England slavery? Go to Boston and look for black Negroes. Or are there not half-breeds in the South who show some family resemblance to doughty federal soldier fathers who fought to set the Negro free? See, what he's saying here is that the Northerners like to blame Southerners for this stuff, and they were hypocrites. Oh, people from Massachusetts especially, for some reason, like to moralize against the South. Are the Negroes of Haiti or Jamaica or Sierra Leone or Dahomey or New England any freer from sexual immorality than the Southern Negro? No, no. The laxity of morals which characterizes it took hold of its victims a long, long time before their masters or their master's sons were ever born. It is certain, says Ratzel, that the Negro has a strong innate tendency to sensuality, and the most various travelers have reported great sexual excesses among the Negro races. Sexual purity among the Guinea natives does not rest upon any regard for chastity as such, but merely on property ownership. Indulgence commences at an early age and continues thereafter with little impediment. Adultery among West Africans is the sexual congress of a wife with a paramour without her husband's consent. We are told by travelers that men can and actually do lend their wives to friends or visitors in West Africa. The wives do not object. And in cases of white visitors they have seemed somewhat chagrined that the hospitality was not accepted. In other words, the white travelers in West Africa were offered some Negro's wife, and they turned it down, and the Negro was sad. This is kind of disgusting. Seduction and rape, just as adultery, are regarded as violations of property rights. If a virgin is violated and her head money paid, any further excesses she may commit are regarded as of no consequence. Among the contributions of antebellum tutelage to the social heredity of the American Negro may be mentioned several which serve to check certain native tendencies that in American society are considered antisocial. The African was found naked and taught to wear clothing. With coarse and boisterous manners, and given examples of decency and refinement for imitation. It is true that the clothing given him was coarse and sometimes inadequate, but that fact does not invalidate the general proposition. 2, he was found homeless and filthy in his habits and given a permanent dwelling place and taught the simpler practices of sanitation. 3, idle and improvident, he was taught to labor, not always economically or efficiently, but enough to introduce it into his social heredity, so to speak. Many were even trained to skill in the useful arts and imbued with ambition for excellence. 4, he was found brutal and impulsive, and there was forced upon him a measure of self-control and fair play, which seems to be on the decline the farther we get away from slavery. Farther blacks get away from the generation that was enslaved, the less self-control they seem to have. Because that's the book I read on here last week said that the crime among blacks had already been increasing in the early 20th century. And I read another one that said it was already increasing in the 19th century. Probably much more now than it was in the early 20th century. He was five. He was found a victim of Grigri's, the witch doctor, and the conjure bag, and was given Christianity. Not all Christianity had to give, but enough to suppress his grosser superstitions and most revolting rites. And I won't ask what that is. Number six, he was found without chastity or a conception of it. Without regard for the marriage bond or the monogamous family, he had forced upon him at least the form of monogamous mating. Not indeed ideal family life, but an immeasurably higher one than he had ever known in his native land. And no people have ever had, for their example, a more lofty standard of female purity than that furnished by the antebellum mistress and her daughters. Much capital has been made of the slave's faithfulness and loyalty during the Civil War, while the master was away from home. I do not deny the facts, but I cannot accept the explanation generally assumed. The simple truth is that the Negro slave, both as an individual and a class, had been trained to obey. His habits had been formed to that end. He had been impressed with the duties of his situation. Loafing and gadding had never been tolerated. He had been trained to respect and obey with special deference the commands of his white mistress and her daughters. He did not know how or feel free to do otherwise. He had no more independent power of initiative than he had in Africa, so he pursued the even tenor of his way. On the other hand, his white mistress had been his doctor and often his nurse in sickness, his religious teacher and his advisor in times of trouble. Her children had been his playmates and his champions. The master's house was a haven of security, and the cruel oppressions of slavery were to him more rhetorical than real. The Negro lives in the present and acts on impulses and the nearest suggestion. He had no immediate cause for uprising. But when the war was over and he saw his master impoverished and impotent, he sat up and took notice. When the federal militia, the carpetbagger, the missionary teacher, and the constitutional amendments came with such confusing precipitancy upon the heels of the Emancipation Proclamation, they broke the hypnotic spell of the old order, and the Negro again became an irresponsible savage. Then neither life nor property was secure, nor even the white woman's honor, except insofar as the ex-slave and the carpetbagger and scalawag knew that death, hell, or the federal militia could restrain the vengeance of the Southerner whose women were violated. But before this, the Negro militiamen had outraged white women, availing themselves of the first opportunity granted to unrestrained African heredity. But after the removal of the federal militia and the precipitate scampering to cover of the carpetbagger, the old habits of command and obedience reasserted themselves. The insolent official and impudent functionary of yesterday became the obsequious menial of today. He was a Negro still, worse for his brief saturnalia of crime and debauchery, better because of his old habits and attitude of submission. The tendency to theft, lying, idleness, sensuality, superstition, and cruelty in the African was curbed, though not, of course, altogether suppressed by the slave master. The Negro could not make fine distinctions, nor always control his impulses, and it showed the wisdom of his master not to make too great demands on him. While the master could have given him more literary education and a broader industrial training, while he could have and perhaps ought to have been more patient and untiring in his efforts to uproot African superstitions and to implant the moral precepts of Christianity, while he could have and perhaps ought to have provided the Negro more of a home life and enforced more strictly the family obligations, and while he could have and certainly ought to have confined his sexual delinquencies to his own race, yet slavery is in no sense responsible as a cause for the moral weaknesses of the freedman and his descendants. They are hereditary. In the very nature of slavery, however, there is scant opportunity for the development of learning, independent initiative, and self-dependence. Upon the mass of slaves, there must, in the nature of the case, exist a condition of degraded self-respect. And ambitions and aspirations must suffer defeat. But knowledge, self-respect, self-dependence, more or less ambition, and personal initiative are necessary to good citizenship in a democratic republic. But the American Negro was unfortunately thrust into full citizenship without such attributes. An unfit citizen easily becomes a pauper or a criminal. Well, you know, there were ancient Greeks that were slaves, like the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, I believe. And they didn't show those characteristics. They didn't all show those characteristics. There were many freedmen, Greek freedmen in Rome, that rose to positions of prominence. Okay, the freedman and the carpetbagger. Transportation from Africa and enslavement in America subjected the Negro to a violent social change. Perhaps there has never been in the history of civilization so sudden and so radical a change involving so many persons. The Negro was the helpless object of his own and the white man's cupidity. And he became the curse of curses to America. He had hardly set foot on American soil before he became a problem. And he is a problem still. We do not know all the factors. We can neither eliminate nor solve the personal equation. But the Emancipation Proclamation and its sequelae subjected the Negro to another very great change before he had adjusted himself to the first. He did not this time change his physical environment, nor totally detach himself from his old master, but his relations were changed. There was a new order of things. The Negro had now the opportunity and, in a sense, the necessity of determining his position in American society. He had to adopt, adapt, or assume new manners and customs and new qualities of character. His old African culture had been well nigh forgotten, but he had acquired more of the form than of the substance of the Anglo-Saxon culture. He still had his African heredity, but slightly modified and unconscious survivals of African religious and other social customs. But they were ill-adapted to the new social order. He was a child, full of hope and eager to play with his new toy. He had freedom now and responsibility, civil rights and poverty, political rights and ignorance. He had his liberty, but could not distinguish it from license, and he had the prerogatives of American citizenship with the shackles of African heredity. True, he had friends, strong friends in the North, and they sent him sentimental missionaries to teach him religion, and the vampire carpetbagger to teach him politics. And he had old friends in the South, but they had neither money nor much influence, and would not treat him on terms of equality, would not treat with him on terms of equality. Many old slave masters employed their old slaves, and relationships did not materially change. Other former masters even divided what they had left from the ravages of war, thus setting up in business their own former slaves. But a majority of the whites had been impoverished by the war and were sore at heart and sensitive in temper. The majority of the Negroes were restive and eager to experience the new sensations of the new regime. So they went a-whoring after strange gods, and their old friends became alienated, means the white slave masters. The Union League, with its secret passwords and nocturnal meetings, the Freedmen's Bureau, with its blare of philanthropy and ignominious downfall on the one hand, and on the other, the Ku Klux Klan, with its aftermath of lawless impositions, all had their day of reckoning in trouble and strife and bitterness. in misunderstanding and injustice on both sides, till in 1876, the Negro ceased to be the ward of the nation and became, for the first time, dependent upon himself. Meantime, his social status had been determined. He was not the white man's equal, nor likely to be. Mr. Lecky, the English historian, discussing the political affairs of the time, says, "The enfranchisement of the Negroes adds a new and enormous mass of voters who were utterly and childishly incompetent. For some time after the war, the influence of property and intelligence in the South was completely broken, and the Negroes were ostensibly supreme. The consequence of what might have been expected, the consequence was what might have been expected. A horde of vagrant political adventurers from the North poured into southern provinces, and in conjunction with the refuse of mean whites, they undertook the direction of the Negro voters. Then followed, under the protection of northern bayonets, a grotesque parody of government, a hideous orgy of anarchy, violence, unrestrained corruption, undisguised, ostentatious, insulting robbery, such as the world had scarcely seen. The state debts piled up. Legislation was openly put up for sale. The bosses were in all their glory, and they were abundantly rewarded. At length the northern troops were withdrawn, and the whole scene changed. The carpetbaggers had had their day, and they returned laden with southern booty to their own states. Partly by violence, partly by fraud, but largely through force of old habits of obedience and command, the planters in short time regained their ascendancy. Sometimes it is said they did not even count the Negro votes. Generally, they succeeded in dictating them, and by systematic manipulation and intimidation, they restored the South to quiet and some degree of prosperity. A more curious picture of the effects of democratic equality among a population who were entirely unfitted for it has never been presented." White supremacy. Following the departure of carpetbaggers and the United States troops who aided, abetted, and protected them, and probably shared in the spoils, came, as Mr. Lecky says, a period of manipulation, intimidation, and dictation to the Negro on the part of the Southern white man. This lasted for about 20 years. But the latter part of this period was a period of political indifference on the part of the mass of Negroes, though agitators both North and South and Negro leaders kept up a pretty constant irritation. The fear of Negro domination through sympathetic political influences in the North and the constant strain of managing the situation locally cramped the South into one political party with a single idea, hampered public institutions, and retarded the progress of the South. Unscrupulous manipulators were coming to control or dictate the Negro vote. The saloon and hoodlum element could usually count on it, while demagogues of little ability and less patriotism rode into office by appealing to the race prejudice of the ignorant whites on the one hand, and by buying or bullying the ignorant Negroes on the other. Finally, tired out with the irritation and consequent race friction, their sense of honor revolting at election frauds and coercive methods, disgusted with the success of the corruptionist and apprehension of the reign of the demagogue, and seeing in it all the black peril looming up larger and larger, thoughtful Southerners set about to devise some effective method by which the Negro might be permanently and legally eliminated from politics. And so the method of outright disfranchisement by state constitutional suffrage amendment was adopted in 7 Southern states. Mississippi was the first to adopt such an amendment in 1892. South Carolina followed in 1895. Louisiana in 1898. North Carolina in 1900. Alabama in 1901, Virginia in 1901, and Georgia in 1908. No other southern states have passed such amendments, though Maryland has tried twice and failed. These suffrage amendments have brought about an undue amount of adverse criticism of the South. So this author, McCord, thinks that this was justified. Negro agitators and their political allies in the North have frothed at the mouth and made dire threats of political reprisal. But there are some very significant facts that stare them in the face when they come to make a test of it. One, suffrage is a franchise and not a natural right. Two, only 7 of the Southern states have adopted suffrage amendments. Three, these amendments as adopted are constitutional. In other words, they make no distinctions as to race, color, or other normal condition impossible to change. Four, the qualifications required are not new, exclusively Southern, or intrinsically unreasonable. Five, the two clauses, the grandfather clause and the understanding clause, to which most objection has been made, are alternative with the education and property tests and are temporary, except that the understanding clause is permanent in Georgia and Mississippi. The time for registering under the grandfather clause has already expired, except in Georgia, where it expires in 1915. That would be a year after this was written. And the understanding clause expired with it, except in Georgia and Mississippi, where it is permanent. Six, nature furnishes about the only qualification for suffrage the average Negro can prove. That is to say, sex and age. The requirements are definite and clear and not onerous, and ample alternatives are provided, but the Negroes do not qualify in any great numbers. If the suffrage is not worth an effort to qualify, why should they want it? This subject will be taken up again and discussed in detail in a future chapter. It is sufficient in this place to say that the Southerner may have been over-anxious about the Negro vote and its influence, and the plan hit upon to eliminate it, not altogether in detail above reproach, yet the plan as adopted seemed the only practicable course to pursue and has thus far proved effective. I think it's talking about poll taxes and literacy tests, that kind of thing. Literacy tests. No concealment of design was attempted, but certain technical barriers had to be overcome and certain temporary expedients provided. So in formulating the qualifications for suffrage, the understanding clause was inserted to eliminate the technically eligible Negro and the grandfather clause to protect the technically ineligible white man. The first manifestly depends upon the integrity and sense of justice of election officers for its fair execution. The second is a transparent subterfuge. Length of residence and payment of taxes and the alternative of education or property ownership are now the only real tests for qualification applied. These tests have eliminated most of the Negroes and a goodly number of whites in the 7 states where such tests are prescribed. I might also point out that there's a similar roundabout way of filtering out blacks that employers use, which is drug testing. The Negro agitator and his political ally, if they had to have a drug test for voting, that could improve things considerably, couldn't it? The Negro agitator and his political allies very insistently demand for the Negroes a part in governmental affairs, but they cannot show that the Negroes have done themselves much credit as administrators. They had ample opportunity during the Reconstruction period. Their childish abuse of it has already been described. The agitator may admit some maladministration, but excuses it on the plea of inexperience and unfortunate alliance with corrupt white men whom they trusted. But the fact remains, and they did no better in North Carolina in 1896-1898. And so North Carolina adopted a suffrage amendment in 1900. In North Carolina, a fusion of populists, Republicans, and Negroes was formed to beat the Democrats. This is the story. In no state of the Union were elections more fairly conducted than there, and in none were the Negroes more kindly and considerately treated. But that very fact nearly caused our ruin. The Negroes, voting as they always have done, as a unit, under the guidance of unprincipled demagogues, through division and disaffection among the white people, carried the elections in 1896, and immediately in the eastern part of the state, where they predominate, the evidence of race antagonism and a disposition to offensively assert equality began to exhibit themselves. Nothing of the kind had occurred except in individual instances since the days of Reconstruction. But it at once became common and grew apace. Demands for office, which their allies dared not refuse, were made and yielded to, and these demands increased until in some localities the administration of public affairs was largely committed to Negro officials and white office holders who were, in many instances, more inefficient, ignorant, and corrupt than their Negro colleagues. Crimes of all sorts increased alarmingly and went unpunished. Negro jurors who sat in every case that was tried refused, in the face of the most overwhelming and undisputed evidence, to convict Negro criminals guilty of outrageous offenses. Well, think of the O.J. trial, right? Think of Trayvon Martin, right? That poor, innocent, 6'3" little boy was stalked and then gunned down by 5'9" octoroon from, you know. The city authorities and police of some places, including the city in which I live, became a laughingstock to lawbreakers, an object of contempt to all good citizens. Eastern North Carolina became a Negro paradise, and immigration to it began from all quarters. Idle and drunken Negroes infested the streets of Wilmington day and night and grew more and more insolent and aggressive. Ladies were frequently and grossly insulted, and citizens assaulted and robbed in broad daylight. Burglaries were of almost nightly occurrence, and no arrests followed. A Negro newspaper was established and crowned a series of offensive articles by an attack upon the virtue of white women in general. Another election was pending, and threats of a demand of a still larger share of offices were made. The election was one of the quietest ever held in the state, and the Negroes polled about 90% of their strength, but a large proportion of their former white allies deserted them because of their conduct. And their party was beaten. Then, and not till then, the white people asserted their supremacy in an unmistakable way, and they intend to preserve it at all hazards forever. It was not the work of ignorant enemies of the Negro, but the long-delayed and spontaneous action of all the white people united for the common purpose of preserving their civilization. And we can hope for that, huh? Of course, there was much misrepresentation of facts and much abuse of the leaders in certain quarters, but it is a sufficient answer to say that no man ever saw all classes of a community, including the clergy, armed and walking guard around their homes when no danger threatened them. The most consistent thing the Negro has ever done has been the most logically consistent thing he could have done, namely to constantly, uniformly, and persistently vote in opposition to his white neighbor in all elections where there was a party issue, and with the riffraff and saloon element where there was a moral issue. The only exception to Republican affiliation, well, this is back when the Republicans were the slave-freeing party, right? The only exception to Republican affiliation I've ever known was when he voted with the rotten Democratic machine in Tennessee against the Lily Whites. The Democratic governor, candidate for governor at that time, also represented the saloon element of the state. That may in part explain. The Negro is, and has been since his disenfranchisement, doggedly opposed politically for no reason he could assign to the white man who has provided labor for him, protected him in trouble, and cared for him in sickness, provided asylums for his afflicted and voted taxes to educate his children, and whose every local and general interest, economic, religious, moral, and civic, is the same as his, and has delighted to vote with any shoddy Republican politician or dirty scalawag who would deign to hobnob with him. The truth is, the Negro, on account of his own weakness, has never been a free and accepted elector, independent and responsible. During Reconstruction, he was bought, intimidated, outwitted, or outcounted by the carpetbagger and the scalawag, and used at their convenience. Since Reconstruction, he has been cajoled with petty gifts and promises, bribed with money, strong drink or barbecue, or controlled by intimidation or ballot box stuffing. Sometimes this has been done by good citizens acting in self-defense, sometimes by the local appointee to federal office who must control the Negro as the price of his job. Sometimes by the unprincipled demagogue who would spare no pains to usurp local government by corrupting the Negro. But as said before, the state of affairs became intolerable to the better class of Southern whites. They were tired of complicity in the underhand methods. But they know the Negro, and they know the corrupt politician, and they know that the two can and will combine to thwart every effort toward decency and moral progress in government, unless means unequivocal, drastic, and permanent are used to prevent such combinations. And that kind of makes me think about the cliche that anti-racists like to spout, that if you have any kind of a negative opinion of Negroes, you are ignorant. Yeah, sure. Who is ignorant in that situation? Negro disfranchisement was the only feasible method by which this could be accomplished, and so suffrage amendments have been adopted in half the Southern states. In the other Southern states, the Negro vote is still a menace, though taken from one year to another, it is largely in a state of suppression. Partly by constitutional provisions relative to length of residence and payment of taxes, and statutory laws relative to primary education, the Australian ballot and the like, I'm not sure what an Australian ballot is exactly, partly by the manipulation of the election machinery under white officials, but mainly by the indifference of the Negroes who have come to believe that somehow or other their vote will not affect the result, the Negro is virtually disfranchised in the ordinary election. And, of course, Jews came down south and fixed that situation. Yeah. Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, the famous Mississippi burning incident. Schwerner and Goodman. Guess what their religion was? Cheney was a Negro. The other two were Jews. The Negro citizen and his education. Along with Reconstruction came the public school and the Negro college for his higher education. And the Negro, in childish hopefulness, saw in book learning what before he had seen in freedom and in politics, a sort of talismanic panacea. He thought there was some magic power in the high-sounding words of the books, and that diplomas and political preference could bridge the chasm between savagery and civilization. His white apologists had told him so. They taught, he believed, and so he is still pursuing a shadow. Only a few, as compared to the many, of the race seem able to grasp the idea of social efficiency or to lay hold upon the essential elements of progress. But they are not to blame, for they know nothing of the long stony way and the threaded mileposts marking the upward climb from the Stone Age to the 20th century Anglo-Saxon civilization. Even before the close of the Civil War, efforts began to be made to educate the Negro. Soon afterwards, colleges began to be established for the purpose. There are now quite a number of such institutions, but only about a dozen of them do college work. Only six have as many as 50 students of college grade. They are the results of Northern philanthropy, freely given at first, later only after persistent solicitation. Most of these colleges are still poorly equipped and inadequately endowed. Multiplicity of named institutions instead of concentration of money and energy upon a few well-equipped, well-endowed, and well-managed colleges has been a wasteful error. In their management and educational ideals, they are modeled after the old-line colleges of the churches. Their curricula are narrow and ultra-conservative. All right. Well, I hope I did an adequate job this time. I know I didn't do as well this time as I did last week. I hope you found something of value in this.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.